This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest has a beautiful and unusual singing voice. Anthony Roth Costanzo is a countertenor, which means he sings in the range associated with women's voices. Some of his repertoire from the 16 and 1700s, music by composers like Handel and Monteverdi, was originally written for castrati, men who were castrated before puberty to prevent their voices from changing and deepening. Costanzo also sings contemporary music and is about to star in the Metropolitan Opera's production of Philip Glass's opera Akhenaten, about the Egyptian pharaoh who was married to Nefertiti. Now some people think that because of Akhenaten's beliefs and because of how he was visually represented, that he may have been gender fluid. On Saturday afternoon, November 23rd, the Met's production of Akhenaten will be broadcast live to select movie theaters around America and the world as part of the Met Live in HD series. We'll hear Costanzo singing an excerpt from Akhenaten a little later, but let's start with an excerpt of Philip Glass's Liquid Days. This is from Costanzo's album ARC, which came out last year and features him singing music by Glass and Handel. Anthony Roth Costanzo, welcome to Fresh Air. You're amazing.
So, thanks for having me, Terry. I'm thrilled.
So let's just start with, what does it mean to be a countertenor?
So a countertenor is essentially a man who sings in a falsetto voice. And the falsetto voice is just particularly resonant and well-developed. And it's that simple.
So what's the difference between what you do and, for instance, what Smokey Robinson does?
Well, actually, we do the same thing physiologically. So every person has these two vocal cords, and they come together. I sort of liken it to blowing grass between your thumbs, if you've ever done that, and it makes a little buzzing sound. You blow air between these vocal cords, and they buzz like a kazoo would. And if we had no head, that's all it would sound like. But the kazoo sound travels up into our bone structure in our face and within our mouth, and it takes shape, it takes color, it takes volume, bouncing around in there, and it comes out as sound. And as opera singers, we learn to sort of use that air and those resonating spaces with the utmost finesse. There are also, of course, muscles involved. There are 60 muscles in the throat. So as a countertenor, we're bringing the vocal cords together, but we're only bringing a portion of them together, say two-thirds of them together, leaving a little space for some extra air to escape. So what that means is that most falsettos in most men are kind of airy because you hear the air escaping, whereas a countertenor learns really how to bring those chords to full approximation, as it's called, meaning fully together, but leaving that little bit that doesn't vibrate and therefore making a very rich, very operatic sound.
It's a tradition that starts in the 1600s?
Well, earlier? Actually, so it begins not with countertenors per se, but with this incredible and kind of horrific creature, the castrato. So as operas beginning in 1599, the first castrati appear in history in the logs of the Vatican Chapel Choir Book. And a castrato is, and forgive me, everyone who's listening, it always makes the men cross their legs when I say this, but a man who, before the age of puberty, has had their testicles usually crushed between two stones. And this was a practice that started in 1599, so as far as we know. And what that did was to preserve the high voice as these men's bodies grew. And so they would have the resonating chamber of an adult, but the vocal cords basically of a boy soprano. And these creatures, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but they were fascinating to the public, and they brought opera to the public. It became a public art form about 25 years later in 1625 in Venice because these castrated singers had made their way into the art form and the public loved them. And why did the public love them? I think about this a lot. I studied it a lot at Princeton where I did my undergrad. And I think it's both a grim fascination, but also there was such an excitement about the high voice being heard in public with that kind of volume. You know, it was a time when women weren't singing in church, which is where much of the music was happening. And so these men...
women weren't allowed to sing in church.
Exactly. Women were forbidden to sing in church. And these men gave a new sound and a new excitement. But also, if I can be so bold, I mean, imagine a time when there's no birth control and you're in a marriage that you're not particularly happy with, and you can fantasize about this man who is sexually functional but not fertile, and you go see them on stage and you imagine having an affair with them. I mean, these castrati became kind of the rock stars of their era, with women and men wearing little portraits of them on buckles and on belts and around their neck. And I mean, it was the first kind of merchandising and celebrity culture. And for 100 years, these castrati were the best paid, most popular singers. Music was written for them by not only Handel, but Gluck and Mozart and Monteverdi and Vivaldi, and all of these composers that you've heard of were writing for castrated men. And these were the men who were leading the opera world. And it was, it's a kind of terrifying and fascinating thing that is at the root of opera's success.
I keep wondering what happened to the castrati who didn't make it as the greatest singers in the world, and they were just left with being castrati but not being rock stars, not being as talented as the best, not being on the stage singing opera.
This is the great sadness. 90% of boys who were castrated didn't make it to have a big career. So you can imagine living life as a monk or as a church singer and not fulfilling this promise to your family, and also having to go through this traumatic experience and then spend all of your childhood. If you were castrated, you were sent off to a conservatory away from your family. There were 4 in Italy, and 4,000 boys a year were being castrated in the height of this.
Wow. Castration.
And, you know, I would often think about why would a parent let their child be castrated? But I guess one rationale is you have 6 children and the priest in the church choir says, listen, this kid is really good. I think he's got a shot. It's kind of like American Idol, right? You know, fame and fortune is at your doorstep. Castrate him. He's a good singer. And, you know, maybe he's going to have this great career. There's a 1 in 10 chance he's going to bring fortune and fame to our town, our family. You know, so I guess it was a tradition. It was exciting. It brought prestige to families who might not have had another way to climb a social ladder.
Did the castrati who did not become stars become outcasts?
Absolutely. And I think the castrati, even who were stars, were seen as freaks. There's a wonderful sketch from the time in London when Farinelli, probably the most famous castrato, was up against Senesino, who was Handel's favorite castrato. And it shows the two of them as these kind of giant figures. Sometimes castrati, because of the hormonal changes, their bones would continue growing and they would become taller or more barrel-chested because their bones were often more cartilaginous, softer bones. And so it depicts these castratos like monsters, like towering giants over the soprano. And they were kind of freaks. They were outcasts. And they had this special skill, which put them in a different category. But I think it's fascinating that in modern opera, countertenors often, up until today, portray outsiders. But in Baroque times, they were always the hero. They were Orpheus. They were Julius Caesar. They were roles that were heroic, even though today, if I said to you, oh, we're doing an opera. How should we cast Julius Caesar? What should his voice sound like? You'd say, oh, we want the bass. We want the deep baritone for the strong general. But in those days, gender and pitch had a different relationship, which I find fascinating. They said, well, the strong voice is the castrato voice. That's the trumpet. That's the sound of a general. So I think the relationship to gender and pitch was different.
I feel like you are, as a countertenor, making some of your performance and some of your approach about gender and gender fluidity. Are there women's roles you'd like to sing?
There's so many women's roles I'd like to sing. All of them. My childhood was singing a lot of Tosca and, you know, Ella Fitzgerald's songs of Gershwin. And, I mean, you know, yes. But is it a part of the opera world? No. Could it be? Well, I think it's important to uphold the traditions which have made opera great while simultaneously trying to think outside of the box about how we communicate this art form to people. So if I were working with a really smart director or a really cool composer where it wasn't necessarily a drag act, although I do love a drag act, but if it were a different way to communicate something feminine through this voice, and there was an interesting take on it, I think it could be fascinating.
I think a lot of people now think that Akhenaten might have been trans. And I think he believed that divinity was a combination of the male and female, which in some ways is not an unusual thought. But why do people think in retrospect that he might have been trans?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. When I first was studying Akhenaten, everyone in text referred to him as a hermaphrodite. And so I was talking to all these Egyptologists as I was researching the role, and I went to Oxford, where Richard Parkinson, a great Egyptologist, and his colleagues met with me, and I said, was he really a hermaphrodite? Did he have both body parts? And they said, well, he's always depicted with these very big hips and full lips and almost breasts. So that's why people think that. But they posited this other theory, which is that he saw God as the unification of man and woman, not a man or a woman. And he wanted to be closer to God. And the ancient Egyptians, invented waxing and all kinds of other distortions of the body. So could he not have changed himself either in a surface way or perhaps more profoundly to be between man and woman? And I thought that was so interesting. Of course, what we call that today and what feels very clear to us is trans. We don't know how they thought about it, but I do think of him as the first trans icon and very fluid, and that's really represented in our production of Akhenaten at the Met, where I enter completely stark naked, probably the first full frontal male nudity at the Met, and it goes on for quite a while in slow motion, 6 minutes, so you see this very male figure emerge, and then over the course of the opera, I kind of transform into someone with these more feminine features.
And more feminine costumes?
Yes, more feminine costumes, but also I wear these kind of gauzy Egyptian linen pleated robes, and underneath them, the costume designer Kevin Pollard and the director Fela McDermott have chosen this kind of slip that has printed a woman's body, a kind of painted woman's body, but from far away, and even from 10 feet away, it looks like breasts and women's genitals, sort of. And it's not graphic in any way, but it is rather very beautiful. And so you see this trajectory of Akhenaten's transformation of thought and also body.
Just tell us a little bit about entering naked. You've done this. You've done other productions of Akhenaten, and you've made your entrance naked before. What is that experience like? And are you wearing any body makeup or anything?
Not very much. There's a little, I think, oil and occasionally a little bit of shading to just help the working out I've been doing furiously for the past 3 months preparing for it. No, when the director asked me to be naked, I said, well, why? And he said, you know, it's going to create this magical effect. And in fact, we don't do it in a way that's sensational, in that I don't kind of run on stage with everything flapping all over the place, but rather I'm revealed and I walk with such slow intensity. And keep in mind, I shave my head entirely, like, you know, with a Bic razor, and wax my entire body, because the Egyptians thought hair was disorderly. So we go full method on this, and I'm this shiny, completely smooth, alien-looking creature who's totally naked, and it takes me about 3 full minutes, which is actually a long time, to walk down 12 steps, and I walk down this staircase facing the audience. And I've learned that if there's any tension in my body, it doesn't work, if I'm nervous about it. But if I stare at the audience with great focus, with great conviction, and completely released, they can't move. They feel, they can't even breathe. I can see it happen. And from that moment on, we have their focus and their attention in a way that lasts the next 3 hours.
That takes confidence.
Yeah. You know, it takes community, actually, is what I've discovered. When I first did it, I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't go naked till the final dress rehearsal, you know, before we open. Then I thought, no, that's crazy. I'll be so nervous. So I said to my castmates, okay, when you're all in costume, you know, and there are a lot of people, there's the chorus and the orchestra and the, you know, it's 100 people or more. I said, I'm just going to be naked from the first time we're in costume on stage. And they said, okay, okay. And Terry, I was standing in this little thing I'm revealed in, and my heart was beating so fast because, you know, you've been in a room with these people for 6 weeks. They know you. You've become friends, and now they're going to look at you naked. And I did the walk, you know, the four-minute walk down the stairs, and we had to stop because a light didn't work or something. And I covered myself, and they all applauded, and we all laughed. And from that moment on, I knew I had this community of people. And that community, it's not only the performers, but the directors and the stage managers and everyone involved. That's what makes a piece of art. And that's the chemistry that you feel come on stage. And that's what allows me to do it. It sort of carries me through, and I feel I'm a part of something larger. It's not just about, you know, 4,000 people staring at my penis.
Well, let's hear you sing something from Akhenaten, and there's no recordings yet from the Met to play, but you did an album of songs and arias by Handel and Philip Glass, and the last track on this is from Akhenaten. It's Hymn to the Sun. So tell us where this fits in musically and thematically in the opera.
Most of the operas in ancient Egyptian and Aramaic and languages like that. And
which you'll have a lot of use for when this is over.
Well, it's been fascinating to learn them. But what's great about the way we do it is we don't actually project supertitles or translations. So you don't have to worry about it. It is a ritual that happens in front of you, and it's like unlocking these spirits of ancient Egypt. And I kind of love that. And I guarantee you will understand everything that's happening, even though you don't get the words. This hymn is the only thing in English, and it's in English because I think it's inside Akhenaten's head. And Philip Glass actually specified that it should be sung in the language of the audience who's in the theater. And that's because it's kind of a prayer and a private moment between Akhenaten and his God. And in our production, a huge sun that's the size of the entire stage, it's actually an inflated ball, most people don't know that, lit from the inside, bigger than you can imagine. It's the size of a room. It envelops the whole stage, and I'm there dwarfed by it, singing about nature and about what this sun means.
Okay, so let's hear Anthony Roth Costanza from his album Ark, featuring music by Handel and Philip Glass. And he's going to be singing Hymn to the Sun from the Glass opera Akhenaten. My guest Anthony Roth Costanza singing Hymn to the Sun from the Philip Glass opera Akhenaten. Anthony Roth Costanza, it's just been a delight to talk with you. Thank you for your generosity in singing for us and showing us some of the things that your voice can do. I wish you just a great good luck. I hope I can say that. I know there's so many stage superstitions, but I'm so looking forward
perfect.
To seeing you in Akhenaten. I just hope it's a wonderful experience for you.
Terry, it's been the thrill of a lifetime to talk to you, and thank you.
Anthony Roth Costanza will star in the Metropolitan Opera's production of the Philip Glass opera Akhenaten, with the first performance November 8th. A matinee performance will be broadcast live to movie theaters on Saturday, November 23rd, as part of the Met Live in HD series. Costanza's album of music by Handel and Glass is called ARC. Earlier this year, Parasite became the first South Korean movie to win the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. It's the latest picture from Bong Joon-ho, the director of Snowpiercer and Okja, and it could also become the first Korean movie to receive an Oscar nomination as Best International Feature Film, the category formerly known as Best Foreign Language Film. Our film critic Justin Chang says, Parasite is a masterful new work from one of the world's most exciting filmmakers.
I was fortunate enough to go into Parasite knowing almost nothing about it. Bong Joon-ho's brilliant new movie packs the kinds of stunning, multi-layered surprises that deserve to be experienced as fresh as possible. I'll tread as cautiously as I can, but suffice to say that Parasite is a darkly comic thriller about two families, the Parks, who are very rich, and the Kims, who are very poor. Mr. and Mrs. Kim live with their son, Ki-woo, and their daughter, Ki-jung, in a cramped apartment in Seoul. Years of poverty have made them shrewd, resilient, and tough, and not above the occasional petty theft. Like the family in last year's great Japanese drama, Shoplifters, they've managed to survive by relying on their wits and on each other. One day, Ki-woo, a high school graduate, gets a job as an English tutor for an upper-class teenage girl named Dahe. Her father, Mr. Park, is a millionaire tech titan, and they live in a gated, modernist fortress of a house designed by a famous architect. Kiwoo begins visiting the house to give his English lessons, and it's there that he meets Mrs. Park, who lets slip that she's looking for an art teacher for her mischief-making young son. Thinking fast, Kiwoo mentions a distant acquaintance who might be good for the job. And within days, his sister, Ki-jung, has been hired as a very expensive tutor. The Kims enjoy their sudden boost in income, even as they strain to keep the Parks in the dark about their family connection and their lack of proper credentials. But the lies don't end there, and their scheme grows only more dangerous in its ambition. For roughly its first hour, Parasite is the most deviously entertaining con artist thriller I've seen in years. Director Bong pulls the pieces together with the elegance and flair of a conductor attacking a great symphony. Inch by inch, the Kims expand their domain. No piece of information, whether it's the matter of the housekeeper's allergy or the sexual habits of Mr. Park's driver, is too trivial to be used to their advantage. Bong draws us into a wicked sense of complicity with the Kims, who for all their duplicity are never hard to root for. But as fun as it is to see the Parks get hoodwinked, Bong doesn't turn them into easy villains. We see how gullible and vulnerable they are behind their bolted doors and a high-tech security system. We see the cracks in their perfect family facade. The actress Jo Yo-jung gives an especially nuanced performance as Mrs. Park, who for all her breezy entitlement lives in the shadow of her cold, unfeeling husband. The Kims, by contrast, are a model of intimacy and fairness. When money and space are this tight, everyone has to pull their weight. They depend on each other so completely that they seem to function less like individuals than like a single organism. Maybe that makes them the parasite of the title, or maybe not. As the movie races toward a suspenseful and terrifying conclusion, it leaves little doubt as to whether the haves or the have-nots represent the greater scourge in a capitalist society. Bong has always been deft at synthesizing thrills and politics. He previously tackled class warfare in his English-language thriller Snowpiercer, but Parasite feels even more closely related to his wonderful 2006 monster movie, The Host, which also followed a desperate family trying to survive. The star of The Host was the popular actor Song Kang-ho, who returns in Parasite as Mr. Kim, and gradually becomes the movie's angry moral center. More than his wife or kids, he understands what it means to be looked down on by people like the Parks, and regarded as less than human. At first you're right there with the Kims, until the story takes the first of many jaw-dropping turns. Parasite is seamless in the way it shuffles moods, tones, and genres, and downright Hitchcockian in the way it manipulates your sympathies. It's a movie of extraordinary cunning and devastating emotional power, and after three viewings, I'm still not sure quite how to classify it. Is it a comedy or a tragedy, a thriller or a satire, an art film or a popular entertainment? Maybe it's best to simply call it what it is, a masterpiece.
Justin Chang is a film critic at the LA Times. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The now notorious Westboro Baptist Church preached hate. My guest is the granddaughter of the church's founder. Megan Phelps Roper was taught as a child that God commanded her to hate sinners, and the sinners perhaps most worthy of her hatred were gay people. But also worthy of God's wrath were the American soldiers who lost their lives in the line of duty, because their deaths were punishment for America's sins and its tolerance of homosexuality. That's why the Westboro Baptist Church picketed the funerals of soldiers, unmoved by their grieving families and friends. Perhaps you remember that one of those soldiers' families sued the church. The case wound up in the Supreme Court. The majority decision ruled in favor of the Westboro Baptist Church on the grounds that even hateful speech, when addressing matters of public import on public property, needs to be protected. Megan Phelps Roper left the church 7 years ago when she was in her mid-20s. She's written a new book called Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Megan Phelps Roper, welcome to Fresh Air. The Westboro Baptist Church was built around hating gay people and seeing gay people as like epitomizing everything that was wrong with the world. What were some of the signs you would hold about gay people? And I want to preface this by saying that these signs used words that are very hurtful and hateful. So just be prepared for some offensive language.
Some of the early signs used the word gay, actually. That's how we referred to gay people. So they said gays are worthy of death. And very quickly, we came to our most, you know, famous message, infamous message, which was God hates fags, which was the name of our, became the name of our website as well. Although, you know, you said that the Westboro Baptist Church was organized around hating gay people. That actually isn't how it was framed for me as a child growing up in the church. It's not how the church sees what it's doing. They try to separate out the hatred of God from what they view as the definition of love thy neighbor. So Westboro would quote this passage from the book of Leviticus that for them shows that the definition of love thy neighbor is to rebuke your neighbor when you see him sinning. And if you don't do that, then you hate your neighbor in your heart because you are watching this person go down this bad path that is going to lead them to the curses of God in this life and hell in the world to come. And you failed to warn them. You didn't give them the opportunity to repent, to share with them the truth of God, which is the love of God.
So another thing the church was very famous for was picketing the funerals of soldiers, of American soldiers. What were some of the signs you and your family would carry when you were demonstrating at the funerals of soldiers?
We held signs that said, "Thank God for dead soldiers. Thank God for IEDs.
God hates you.
God hates you. You're going to hell." There was another specific, pray for more dead soldiers.
Wow.
That became a sign that we held as well.
What was the rationale for that? How can you justify, what were you told that would justify this kind of hatred for soldiers who died?
I was 19 years old when we started protesting soldiers' funerals, and this was a question that I had. We had spent my life growing up celebrating death and tragedy. You know, anytime some celebrity that the church viewed as sinful, which was basically everyone, whenever some famous person would die, we would be celebrating. So there was a point, you know, when I was 11 years old and, you know, Princess Diana and Mother Teresa died within a week of each other, and I, you know, modeling what my grandfather had said, you know, I said, two whores in a week. Like, that's literally how we thought about sinful people who passed away. And protesting their funerals was also a habit. But when I was 19 years old, that's when we started protesting soldiers' funerals. And so I went to my mother a couple weeks after this started and asked my mother, you know, why, I need to understand why we're doing this. I need to be able to articulate this when people ask me why we're doing this. And so we sat down as a family and started having this conversation. My mom starts the conversation in the book of Deuteronomy, this passage where God says, "I set before you this day a blessing and a curse, a blessing if you obey me and a curse if you won't." And she said, "Can we all agree that a dead child," that's how my mom, you know, referring to these fallen soldiers as children, because many of them were my age and younger, and I was only, you know, 19. She says, "Can we agree that a dead child is a curse from God and not a blessing?" And so it's these passages that where there is an explicit connection between sin and punishment, and specifically, as Westboro would put it, if when a nation has institutionalized sin against God, God responds, one of the weapons in his arsenal is to kill their children in battle. So again, we saw it as a loving thing to go to these families and say, if you don't repent, you will also likewise perish.
What was it like for you to be carrying signs like that while watching people grieve their son, their husband, their wife, their parent? You were telling them God hated them, and that's why they just lost their loved one. God hated them. God hated the dead soldier. So tell me how it felt.
The very first protest, soldiers' funeral protest that I went to was in Omaha, Nebraska. And I felt like we were trespassing in that moment, which was not a normal feeling for me on the picket line because, you know, we basically saw public sidewalks as that was our territory. That was our turf. You know, I had grown up standing on public sidewalks saying things that people, you know, were very provoked by and were upset by. But standing outside that first soldier's funeral, it was eerily quiet. There was so many people, but, you know, almost no, you know, there were people coming and going. There were a lot of police officers standing, you know, kind of standing guard between us and the people going into the funeral. You know, everybody's, you know, over there in uniform and looking very serious and somber. And some of them, obviously looking at us, completely disgusted. And I felt like we were trespassing. And it was very uncomfortable. Very shortly after that first funeral, though, the dynamic at those protests started to change. So there was this group called the Patriot Guard Riders who would come out with American flags and kind of stand in a line to try to have those flags block our picket signs. So standing guard between us and the family. And sometimes they would bring, you know, there would be a lot of motorcycles and they would rev their engines so that, you know, our chants and songs singing praises to the homemade bombs that were killing these soldiers, that those would be drowned out by these motorcycle engines. It had started to become like a game, almost like a circus, like how we could get our message through these barriers that they were trying to put up. And obviously, looking back, that's something that absolutely fills me with regret.
Yeah, because you're turning those funerals into a drama about you.
Yes, exactly. And we would say it wasn't about us. We would say that it was about God. And that was how we viewed it. My grandfather, who founded the church, he would say, this message is so important. It is more important for these people to hear. They need it more than they need air to breathe, food to eat, or water to drink. So it was this very serious thing, a very somber and sober thing for us as well.
So you grew up believing that your family, who were the members of the Westboro Baptist Church, that they were basically right and everybody else was wrong. Because
yes.
No one else believed, even people who were incredibly homophobic, didn't mm-hmm. believe that you should be picketing the funerals of dead soldiers. I mean, you crossed so many lines. But you must have felt like you were so privileged to be growing up in the only family in America that really understood what the Bible means and what justice really means and what righteousness really means.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we thought other people outside the church were either evil or delusional, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Or ignorant, yes. We absolutely believed that we had the truth of God. And the thing is, my grandfather generally didn't say things like, we are the only people going to heaven. He would instead point to other people, other groups, Methodists and Lutherans and Catholics and, you know, anybody who didn't believe what we believed. And he would point to them and say, here's what they believe. Here's why they're wrong. Here's the chapter and verse that shows it. Memorize it. In other words, by constantly attacking other people for what they believed, it became very clear to us that there was no refuge outside of Westboro. And they would say, this is the only church on the landscape that is preaching the Word of God, the unvarnished Word of God, and not trying to change it, to temper it, to be palatable to the human mind, which is inherently at odds with God. So absolutely, it felt like such a privilege. And that's, they would say that, you know, how lucky we were to have been born in this place where God meets with his people. And that's absolutely how I saw it from a very young age.
We should talk a little bit about the origin story of the Westboro Baptist Church. It was founded by your grandfather, who was the preacher for the whole time you were an active member of the church. He moved to Topeka, Kansas in 1954, the year of Brown versus Board of Education, the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. And this was the Supreme Court decision that overturned separate but equal and said that school segregation, legally mandated school segregation, was no longer legal. So that's when your grandfather moved to Topeka. He became a civil rights lawyer. He was honored by the NAACP. How did he end up founding this church?
For my grandfather, there was no tension between his support for civil rights for black people and his, you know, his animus toward gay people, because both of those positions were scripturally derived, you know, about, you know, discrimination against against black people. He would quote these passages, God has made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the earth. And so that it was necessary for all of us to be equal under the law. The verse was, one law shall be to him that is homeborn and to the stranger that sojourns among you. So he absolutely believed in equality under the law. But he also believed, because it also comes from the Bible, that passage in Leviticus about, you know, says, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. So for him, it was as clear as day, as plain as day, that we should not, that racism is a sin, and that gay people, that God hated them.
You became the social media person for the Westboro Baptist Church. And you were as provocative as you could be because it would get a good response. And that was your goal, to, you know, basically inflame people. But through that, I think it's fair to say that helped you start to doubt your own beliefs. Tell us a little bit about some of the tweets that came back to you from the outside that made you think twice about what you were believing and what you were writing.
I got on Twitter in 2009, so I was 23 at the time. For me, I just saw it as a place to go and spread Westboro's message. And initially, the response that I got there was the same kind of, you know, hostility and contention that I got on the picket line. But pretty quickly, that changed. You know, of course, there was still a lot of hatefulness kind of being reflected back at me. But then there was this group of, you know, individuals who recognized that I was sincere, who recognized that I thought that I was doing the right thing. So then they started asking questions and kind of digging into our theology in a way for them to actually understand it in, you know, with nuance that's really difficult to find when you are looking at a picket sign, 3 to 5 words on a neon sign. It's not easy to get into to find contradictions in there because people don't really understand what we were trying to say a lot of the time. And so as they're able to find these contradictions and present them to me in a way that I understood that we could be wrong about something. And for me, that was mind-blowing because, you know, it wasn't just my grandfather who was an attorney. My mom, both of my parents actually, and my mom and her siblings and many of their spouses are attorneys. They're very intelligent and their arguments are well-crafted and tightly woven. And so they always had an answer. There was always a Bible verse to justify. And so now to be presented with, you know, this contradiction and to realize that, no, this really is a logical contradiction. It is a scriptural contradiction. The realization that we could be wrong was the beginning of the end for me.
You met the man who became your husband through social media during this period when you were tweeting the church's beliefs. How did he engage you, or how did you engage him?
His first tweet was kind of nasty, mean, but immediately his tone shifted. He was really surprised that, you know, I think he expected, like many people expect, that Westboro is full of hillbillies and rednecks, and to meet somebody who is, you know, as he would put it, intelligent, but, you know, misguided. He was really shocked by that a smart person could truly believe these things in the 21st century. And so he started asking questions. And unlike some other people on Twitter were making more theological arguments, his were more emotional, kind of forcing me to look at the human impact of what we were doing. So we had always we'd always been dismissive of the idea that what we were doing was truly hurtful to anybody. You know, they were just being dramatic. They were worshiping their feelings. So we'd been very dismissive and callous to those things. And to have this person, and over time, you know, we're developing this rapport, and I'm coming to understand where he's coming from. He's asking me questions, and I'm asking him questions back, and so it's kind of this back and forth. And I started to feel empathy, and over time, I started to feel like I was becoming part of this community on Twitter. And that was when the first time that I really felt ashamed of what I was doing.
After you left the church and said goodbye to your family, was that supposed to be the final goodbye once you became an apostate? Were they even allowed to talk with you anymore?
They're not supposed to. That is the understanding, is that if you even see them out in public, there should be no interaction at all. They just pretend not to see you.
So did you communicate with them afterwards?
Shortly after I left, my sister and I left, we were talking, and, you know, we had at first been following the rules about not contacting them. And then we realized pretty quickly, we have nothing to lose, and we have nothing to gain by following those rules. We have nothing to lose by reaching out to them. And so I kind of started to have this feeling, you know, I had been despairing of ever having my family again. And then, you know, of course, I realized that if I was changed by these discussions with outsiders, if they could find a way to get through to me, even though I did not want to be gotten through to, I was so zealous and I was such a hardcore believer, how stupid would it be? How wrong would it be not to have that same hope that my family could change, that my mother could change? And so, you know, we start sending letters and birthday gifts and tweets and talking in interviews that we know that they'll see, and making these arguments and hoping that even if it doesn't cause them to leave Westboro, if it can cause them to moderate in some way, if it can help them see that protesting funerals is not a biblical thing, that is not the fulfillment of Paul saying to the weak, I became as weak. So we make these arguments and hope that something will get through. And I think some things have.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Megan Phelps Roper is the author of the new book, Unfollow, a memoir of loving and leaving the Westboro Baptist Church. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.